Welcome in to another edition of At the Buzzer Podcast on RalphieReport.com and SBNation.com. No Sam, no Jack. This is Jeff Hauser. I'm taking over this edition, and I have two special guests here with me. I got Ian Sinclair, and if you know him and if you've followed his work over at Mile High Report, you know he's a great writer covering the Broncos, and a very special guest, Nick Ferguson, who you know from 104.3 The Fan, and who actually played 10 seasons in the NFL. So, guys, thank you both for coming on. I greatly appreciate it. I know this is a little bit late, but I'm so glad that you guys could actually come on and have this conversation with me. And right out the gate, going to hit a little bit of topic on the University of Colorado. When we're talking about the football program from where it was last year to this year, knowing that Carl Durrell has been there almost a complete year as head coach of the Colorado Buffaloes and under the pandemic, looking back on that hire that you had for Rick George and for the program, do you think that, one, it was the right hire, and two, given everything with COVID, how much of a learning curve does he get? And Ian, I'll start with you.
I think that first season for Carl is going to be huge for him in this program, especially with the unusual and difficult circumstances that he had in Boulder in that first year, given the COVID-19 pandemic and being hired in the situation that he was with Mel Tucker leaving for Michigan State. So I think that's going to be a huge benefit to him in this program, because now he has an idea for the players he has and the players that he wants to get. And I think I really do think the sky's the limit for the Buffs in this program going forward. And with, as well as they played, taking away how they played against Utah to end the season and then in the bowl game, I think they really are set up to be a successful program for the foreseeable future with Carl Durrell and his staff, and the way that they set it up for success with this previous season.
Same question to you, but I'll preface it like this. Coming from your coaching background, you have a situation where you've had three coaches in less than 2 years. How hard is that to stomach that's hard to stomach at the pro level, but knowing that you're a college recruit trying to make your way for the next 4 years or for this foreseeable future, how hard is it on a guy?
Well, it is definitely tough on recruits, because you were being recruited by Mel Tucker, and then he decides to go to Michigan State, and Carl Durrell comes in, and he's trying to convince you to stay with the Buffs program and not opt to go to another school or even follow Mel Tucker to Michigan State. So it's always tough, because you never know how the situation is going to pan out. And if you're a recruit and you're a parent of a recruit, you don't really know Carl Durrell that well. He's coming in the 25th hour, promising your kid some of the same things that Mel Tucker promised, but you're not really sure. So at the end of the day, you try to make the best decision that you feel for your kid. And from an academic standpoint, and for Carl Durrell, who was able to convince some of the kids who had already committed not to decommit and come to the school, I mean, that shows or speaks a lot about him as a coach. And if you're a CU Buffs fan, you got to be happy, because they went out and grabbed a guy who's quite familiar with the institution and the tradition that was established years ago. So it makes you happy as far as looking forward to where the organization could go. And watching Carl Durrell come in under the circumstances of Mel Tucker leaving how he left and dealing with COVID, which a lot of college programs were dealing with it, I would say he did a darn good job of dealing with the circumstances. So I'm really optimistic to see what he does with the program moving forward.
And then, given COVID, do you give him a longer learning curve than most? I mean, most would say, give him a recruiting cycle, but do you give him more time, knowing that he came in, he wasn't able to meet with players, he wasn't able to make the hires right away that he wanted to and hit the ground running. So do you think that he in turn will get more time on the back end from the university, and does does that set CU back in a way?
No, it doesn't, because the whole idea is every college program went through COVID. And after you get through the initial surge of COVID, as we're starting to push through now, now it's going to be looking at what he's doing moving forward. Has he recruited the right guys? Has he put them in position to be to win the Pac-12 championship? So, yeah, I mean, this year, let's just say it was kind of a throwaway year, if that. And after this year, now you're still competing against some of these other top-tier Pac-12 teams. So you have to continue to turn over this roster, and you have to make sure you are successful, because if you are not, then now Cardarrelle could find himself looking for another college coaching job.
Ian, what do you say about that?
I totally agree with Nick. I think to steal a college phrase, I think you could view this as a redshirt year for Cardarrelle. And the fact that it was as successful as it was, given all of that, like both Nick and I have said, I think you need to feel good about where this program is headed, that it's headed in the right direction. And while it doesn't, I don't think it gives him any added time, because I think that Nick said it succinctly, that you still have to win. Like college football, especially a Power 12 conference like the Pac-12, it is a what have you done for me lately conference, and he's going to have to continue to win. So while the optimism is high, but the expectations are high too. So I think it's going to have to live up to that, but I think it's definitely on the right path. And I think the fans of the program, boosters, students, all of them should be optimistic and excited about what is coming in Boulder.
So you both say that as of right now, if you're a booster, if you're an alum, you bought into Cardarrelle. You think this is where CU needs to head for the foreseeable future.
Well, yeah, I mean, for right now, based on what we know, obviously, you know, if you lose a lot of games, that changes a lot of things as far as the level of commitment that the institution is, you know, making to you. It still is a game about wins and losses. So that's the best way to maintain, you know, job security. Obviously, in the NFL, you know, there's an old adage, you know, availability, you know, is like job security. You know, you have to be available. So in college football, it's like you have to win games. Everyone is dealing with the same circumstances. They're trying to recruit in a whole COVID pandemic, and you're not going to get like a get out of jail free card because of. If you continue to win in this environment, in this situation, you not only prove your self-worth, now you're talking about, you know, Cardarrelle signing a contract extension maybe two seasons from now.
Switch gears here from CU and hit the other 11 teams, if you will, in the conference and talk a little bit further about what's going on in the Pac-12. If Larry Scott out, he's riding off into the sunset. There's been a lot of things that have happened under his leadership that has been controversial, most notably TV rights and the lack of funding for a lot of things. And this has been at large a huge problem for the Pac-12. But now that the search committee has been set up, you've got them looking for the commissioner for the next 10 or so years of the conference. But I think the two biggest things that commissioner is going to be faced with is game times and how do they compete with other bigger conferences like the SEC, the ACC, and the Big Ten, knowing that you haven't had a team, you only had one team in the college football playoffs since its existence, which was Washington in 2016. So my question for both of you is, how does the Pac-12 get back into being competitive, and what does that look like from a future standpoint? And Ian, we'll start with you.
I think the key is you have to get the games in front of as many people as possible. So you can't have a situation where there are people with Comcast or DirecTV or Dish who can't watch the games. That has to be ironed out. That should be the most important thing that this new commissioner comes in and does, is make sure that every person who wants to watch the Pac-12 network can watch the Pac-12 network. And then I think you said it, is that you need to get the game times in a situation where they're not starting at 10 p.m. Eastern time, if not a little bit later than that. And I think that that's going to be a difficult situation, but it needs to be a way that you get it in front of as many people as possible, and it's at a time where more people can watch it. And I think if they can do that, it starts to be in the right situation.
Well, that's the biggest thing, and I mean, if you have a product and no one actually sees the product, I mean, do we know what type of product you have? You can tell us how great it is, but we want to lay eyes on it. It's like the same situation with the Nuggets and the Avalanche, right? You know, if we, as a fan, you want to see them play, but we don't have that luxury due to television rights. And this is where a lot of leagues that came in and try to compete with the NFL, the reason they felt because they didn't have those big television deals. So television viewership is going to be so important. And this is where we see, even with the Heisman voting, some of the top players in the Pac-12, they're left out because most people on the East Coast, they don't really get a chance to see them play. So how do you do that? Will you be able to schedule some of those games earlier in the day, in the afternoon? And if so, does that mean that you run into a conflict where you have SEC games versus Pac-12 games? And we already know that the SEC is king. And now it is that as though ESPN has a deal with SEC, they're going to make sure that those games are seen. So whoever the next commissioner that comes in, I mean, I don't sympathize with him because this is a tough situation that he's going to be in. So how do you figure that out? You're able to get your product and match it against some of the top conferences and the college football.
Yeah, you guys are absolutely right.
I think one way that could help is, like, the SEC has a network deal with CBS. This new commissioner can come in and maybe negotiate something with ABC or with one of those big networks. I mean, I know Notre Dame has that deal with NBC, but maybe there's a way that they can come in and negotiate something similar to what the SEC has with CBS. And then you get that national presence on a national network, on a station that everyone gets, regardless if they stream or if they still have a cable provider or a satellite provider. So that could be one way to look at it too.
But does the tricky part from that become competing with the bigger brands? I mean, I think that's where the Pac-12 is at right now. And like you said, in with NBC, you know, you always know that Notre Dame's coming on. With CBS, you always know that the big game in the SEC is always going to be on CBS. Maybe they could strike a deal with ABC and ESPN and try and forge that relationship a little bit more. But I think at the end of the day, the Pac-12 is still running third in a race where you want to be one or two.
Well, here's what I'll add to that, because you talk about brand. We already know what the SEC has as a brand, and it has Alabama. You need to find, well, who's going to be that Pac-12 school to kind of lead the charge, because it's all about star power, right? And that's what you usually see in the SEC. When you look at the Pac-12, where are you getting that from a player standpoint? Who are your quarterbacks who can, you know, draw national attention? Who are your coaches that can draw national attention? So as you start to look to hire coaches and recruit players, you got to go out and kind of bring in and recruit some of those top kids that maybe he went to high school, maybe in the South, and Nick Saban was trying to recruit him, but you were able to land him. Now people want to follow that player, right? If you can do that, now you're talking about being able to compete with those guys, because that's what it boils down to. Can your brand, or can you build a brand that's able to compete with the SEC? That's basically what it is.
I agree with you guys. I think whoever the next commissioner of the Pac-12 is going to be, they got a lot to deal with. And there's a lot of things for them to unpack, even over the next 2 years, to even have the Pac-12 be competitive. Let's switch gears here. And since I have both of you, we have to talk Broncos. There's no way, shape, or form that I cannot get you guys to talk Broncos. The biggest story in this offseason, or to me, is a non-story that has been pushed as a story, is Von Miller. And the allegations that have come up against him that have been propagated by several media agencies. where does this story stand? Why does it have significance? And really, where's it going to go? I want to hear from both of you on this. And I guess, Nick, we'll start with you.
Well, for me, it is about being good as a journalist and also being great as far as being arresting officers or police department here. And in this situation, we're talking about Parker Police. Anytime you put something out there where there are allegations or criminal allegations, right away, people's antennas go up. But now we're looking for charges to be filed, someone to be sequestered where there's an interview that takes place. But since that hasn't happened, it's led a lot of people to think, well, is this some kind of a goose hunt or whatever, just to kind of target Vaughn? But Vaughn is in a very different, you know, situation, considering the fact that he's on a club option, right? And these are the type of things that you don't need to have when you're having difficulties with your contract. And now, known as though the Parker Police turned things over to the DA, now is left in the DA's hand to figure out, you know, is there enough evidence to convict Vaughn on some criminal charges? And hopefully, you know, by turning it over, there's some concrete evidence, because I always quote, you know, movies, and I like to quote this movie, you know, Training Day. It's not what you know, it's what you can prove. So if there's any kind of evidence that proved that Vaughn was very violent towards the mother, the expecting mother of his child, then that's going to look bad for him. But to me, you don't come out as a police department or member of the media unless you know for 100% sure that there is going to be a charge and there's true evidence.
I 100% agree. I think this is a situation where, for me as a journalist, whether I'm doing sports betting at Play Colorado or I'm writing about the Broncos at Mile High Report, it's better to be accurate than first. Just be right. And I think this is where you wait for the facts to come out. You wait for the district attorney, as Nick said, to make its decision, and then go from there. At this point, anything that anyone says is just speculation. So let it play out, let the decision be made, and then report on it. Now, if there's a way that someone gets information from a source with the district attorney's office or the Parker Police, then so be it, but that hasn't happened yet. So I'm in the mode where wait for the facts to come out. It's a situation that no one wants to be in, whether you're in the Broncos, you're Vaughn Miller, you're a fan, you're in the media, but let it play out. And I do think in terms of Vaughn's contract situation, as a fan, I want him to stick around. I want him to be with the Broncos. He's been one of the most important Broncos in history. I think he can still have an impact on this defense, but it's a matter of return on investment. What are the Broncos going to get when he gets back on the field, given he's just coming off another injury? So all of this plays into it, but in terms of the off the field stuff, I'm more, like I said, I'm in let it play out and let the facts come out as they do.
I agree with both of you. I think that this is just going to continue to lag on until we either have charges or don't have charges. But in either regard, you've got a situation that is not good and doesn't look good from an outsider's perspective. But when you really read into this, the allegations were a month and a half ago. It got pushed to the DA. The DA's office hasn't done anything in the last 3 days that they've had the case. So I don't know if there will be anything that will come of it. I guess we'll just have to stay tuned and see. Another big topic that has been floating around with the Broncos is Drew Lock. And I will ask both of you, who's going to be the starting quarterback for the Broncos next year? Ian?
I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to say Deshaun Watson.
Okay, Nick, what say you?
Well, first of all, I want to say that's a long limb that Ian just went out on by saying that, because I want him to explain how does that happen. Listen, as a guy that played here in Denver, I would love for that to happen because I know the type of player Deshaun Watson is. But Ian, can you just entertain me for just a second and tell me, how will the Broncos actually get that accomplished?
So I think the one way that it helps is there's now a bigger distraction in Russell Wilson. So that's going to be the big prize that I think people are going to want to potentially get. And I get that his agent came out and said that there's four teams that he'll go to: the Saints, the Bears, the Raiders for some reason, and the last one's escaping me, but
the Cowboys.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that could be something that influences and helps, but I can feel it in my gut. And I've said this on my podcast with Adam Malnati, where over the course of the Peyton Manning situation, and I get that the two situations are entirely different. Peyton Manning was a free agent. Deshaun Watson is under contract with the Texans, and the Texans are locked in. They're not even taking calls, which I think is hilarious that they're people leaving voicemails for their trade offers. I guess it's better that it's not a fax machine, but it just feels like it's going to happen. And I don't know if it's because as a fan and a writer for the team covering it, that I'm so desperate for anything that would look like competent quarterback play, but it just feels like it. And whenever there's smoke, there's fire. There've been reports from Jeremy Fowler, from James Palmer, from Mike Kliss. Maybe it's just my orange and blue goggles and that's deep down in my gut, but it just feels like it. It just feels like George Payton is going to be able to swing this and finally take a sledgehammer to that quarterback carousel that we've all wanted to get off of for 5 years.
Well, I'll say this. I would love for it to be Deshaun Watson. I doubt if it will be based on, Kliss and all these other reports. And you mentioned James Palmer, because once again, if the Houston Texans are steadfast that they're not budging and they're not trading Deshaun Watson, they're doing either one or two things. They're just building up the price tag for as far as what teams will have to fork over to kind of acquire a guy like Deshaun Watson, or they're not moving at all and they're going to force, Deshaun Watson in a tight situation and call his bluff. Because I don't see how the Broncos can finagle that, knowing as though there are other teams that have the draft capital that they can fork over in the trade, and they're suited and they're in a better position than that of the Denver Broncos if they acquired him. So I'm going to go with a guy like maybe Teddy Bridgewater, as I said before. It doesn't sound as fancy as a Deshaun Watson, but it is a trade that George Payton could actually make, because both he and Pat Shurmur are both familiar with Teddy Bridgewater, and you will not have to give over that much draft capital to do so. And you still have an opportunity to allow Drew Lock to develop. And here's a great part. You still can go out in the draft in the third and fourth round and pick up one of these other quarterbacks. I like Ian Book. I don't know about you guys, but I like Ian Book out of Notre Dame. And I'm sure day one, he can walk in and beat out Drew Lock just like that, because he's a better quarterback.
Now, hold on. Touchdown Teddy's going to come in as a backup or a starter?
No. Touchdown Teddy's coming in as a starter. He's not. Whoa. Everyone's talking about the whole idea of competing with Drew Lock. No, there's no competing with Drew Lock. Teddy comes in and he's the bona fide starter. Now, I know that it's not like the sexy pick that everyone, is going to have Broncos fans lining up and buying jerseys, but here's what I know about Teddy Bridgewater. Teddy Bridgewater had the Minnesota Vikings rolling, and he was just one Blair Walsh field goal away from beating the Seattle Seahawks, and then he injured his knee the next year. Now, Teddy Bridgewater went into New Orleans, and he was able to keep their playoff hopes alive by going 5-0 with Drew Brees out of the lineup. To me, that stands for something, because you've been behind Drew Brees, so you learned a lot from him. Also, you were in an awesome offensive scheme with Sean Payton running the ship. Now, you tell me that's not a good bridge player for the Broncos.
Yeah, hold on. I'll tell you this, and I don't know if you knew this or not, but Teddy's best stats came last year, not in Minnesota, in Carolina. Had the most passing yards. He threw for almost 3,800 yards with 15 touchdowns, which are both career highs. But he also had 11 interceptions. Now, I think there may be something to that. I mean, you can't always account for interceptions, especially when you don't have a premium type receivers like you would here in Denver. So I'll give you that. I'll say that I didn't really put too much to the Teddy Bridgewater conversation, but you might have thrown me into that direction. And the other thing, you really think that Ian Book's going to be around, third round type guy, third, fourth? You really think he's going to be there?
Well, Jeff, here's what we know, and Ian can speak to this too. Usually what happens, there's always something that happens in the first round, right? Some team that no one expected decide that they wanted to move up, a team trades back, and then that affects the entire draft. Guys who we thought were going to be taken in the first, going off the board first, the first five picks, now those guys are still staying on the board where teams are picking at the 20th spot in the first round. And when that happens, it pushes every guy who was anticipated to go early, it pushes them back. So I'm anticipating that's going to happen this year, because there's no way all of these quarterbacks that are coming out, they're not all going to go off the board right away, because not every team in that top 10 actually needs quarterbacks.
Mm.
Look at Drew Lock from the draft a couple of years ago, where a lot of people thought he was going to go to 10 and he fell to the top of the second round.
So right.
That speaks to what Nick was talking about. And then in terms of the teams that always seem to surprise people with their picks, you would look at the Raiders. They always find a way to surprise with what they pick, especially in the first round.
That's definitely, I think you definitely have something there. When I look at the NFL draft and how it stacks up this year, this is going to be a quarterback heavy draft. You got Trevor Lawrence, who I think is going to go number one. Now, shoot me if I'm wrong, but I really think that Trevor Lawrence is number one, no matter what. He's the best quarterback out of this draft class. He's the best quarterback probably that we've seen in the draft in a long time. He is a formidable number one. I think he stays there. I don't think there's anything that can happen from here. Now, I've been proven wrong before, but I think that if I'm looking at this correctly, he's going to be the top pick of the draft. Trevor Lawrence, and who in your guys' mind is that number two out of this draft class?
Ian, I'll let you take that one first.
I think it's between that. This is where you never know, because we're in lion season. So I have no idea what to believe from here. I mean, I've watched Justin Fields. Justin Fields is hell of a quarterback. Zach Wilson, hell of a quarterback. Trey Lance, hell of a quarterback. I don't think you could go wrong with either three of those guys.
What about the Heisman winner? You have Mac Jones still up there too.
Well, I mentioned lion season. I think that's
right.
I think he's out of that top four, at least in my opinion. Since I'm in the sports betting business, if I had to put money down, I would probably go with Zach Wilson from BYU as the second quarterback taken in the draft.
Well, I understand why you would say that, Ian, because he is starting to move up a lot of draft boards. But here's my issue with Zach Wilson. Looking at the fact that he played at BYU, what type of top 10 or top, well, he hasn't really played against top 10 talent. Let's start there first. And there's a questionable game against Coastal Carolina that it definitely, you know, comes up. But when you look at Trevor Lawrence, he's a proven guy. Justin Fields, he's a proven guy. When you look at Trey Lance, there's some speculation of what type of player is he, but I like his size at 6'4", 226 pounds. He can do everything that quarterbacks are being asked to do in today's NFL. I mean, I'm not going to say he reminds me of another particular player, but he possesses a skill set that if he's with the right system and the right coordinator, he could have success. Now, when it comes to Mac Jones, I'm not really sold on Mac Jones, because we look at how long has Mac Jones actually started at Alabama? Not that long, right? And we were speaking, look at the previous Alabama quarterbacks and say, well, those guys had a lot of success because they had a lot of talent around them. Just think, Jeff, the Heisman Trophy winner, Devontae Smith, that's who Mac Jones had to throw to, right? So it makes life for him as a quarterback that much easier. And then Mac Jones, once again, he doesn't have the skill set as Lawrence, Wilson, Fields, and Trey Lance is being able to move around in the pocket. Heck, even Kellen Mond from Texas A&M, he has more of the skill set of the top four quarterbacks than Mac Jones. So for me, the second quarterback coming off the board, if it's not Justin Fields, then someone has screwed it up big time.
I agree with you there. I think that I think Justin Fields is going to be the steal of this draft. Whoever gets him, however deep he falls into this draft, if it's, you know, 5 picks, 10 picks, I think that he is the steal of this draft outside of Trevor Lawrence. I think the two are going to be very good in the NFL. Another name that I'm going to throw out there that you guys have been talking Heisman, who is a Heisman front runner in a lot of people's minds, was Kyle Trask of Florida. And the reason I say that, he is a prototypical guy when you're talking about the height, the structure, the build, and the arm strength that the Broncos have gone after in the last decade. Is Kyle Trask a day two guy that the Broncos may look at to come in here and fill a pivotal backup role?
It looks fancy because Kyle Trask's name was mentioned as far as the Heisman race. But then I go back to the game against Oklahoma, right? A game that he was pulled from. He threw 3 interceptions. Now after having a great collegiate campaign to that point, you get to a bowl game that is all important because that's the last impression that everyone's going to see of you. You throw 3 interceptions and you're pulled out of the game. I was like, no, I don't know about Kyle Trask. If you want to push him to day 3, maybe it's a great pick, but I'm not taking him, you know, in the second round, especially if there's other quarterbacks out there. And I will be shocked if a team decides to do that. That would be the ultimate sign of desperation. But you speak of the Broncos, and when I think about what the D stand for and the Broncos now, it is desperation. So I can see them making a move like that.
I don't see it happening. I think I don't see them picking a quarterback in the draft if they don't get someone like a Deshaun Watson or a Teddy Bridgewater or even a Ryan Fitzpatrick for that matter. I don't think the quarterback is going to come from the draft. I think they will go cornerback, they'll go edge, and they'll go offensive line. You can never have too much depth. So I don't think the quarterback is going to come from this draft from the Broncos' perspective. Maybe on a day 3, maybe a day 2 pick, whether it's the 3rd round, that could potentially be something that they do. But I don't see the Broncos taking a quarterback, at least in the early rounds of this year's draft.
Interesting. I think you guys give a great perspective on where the Broncos may be and how this may shake out. I don't know if either one of you saw the earlier report from today from Ian Rappaport, the NFL Network's own Ian Rappaport, but he went and said that he could confirm that teams are calling to see what the Broncos are willing to give up for Drew Lock. So, knowing that, does that throw a different set of circumstances into this equation, knowing that if the right suitor comes along with the king's ransom, what happens then in this whole situation with the Broncos? And do you guys think that he, I know, Nick, I know you've expressed this, but Ian, do you think that Drew Lock, knowing that Deshaun Watson, if what you're saying comes to fruition, I mean, do you think that they in turn package him up and ship him off? And what do you think they'll get in return for him if that's the case?
I think the only way the Broncos ship Drew Lock is if it's for Deshaun Watson. And I think that's why it could, that's why I think the deal could happen. And to go back to why I think it could happen when Nick asked that question, it's because I do think the Broncos are intriguing. And I think Deshaun Watson would want to be a part of this, especially with the weapons that they have on offense, with Courtland Sutton, with Tim Patrick, if he's tendered, with Jerry Jeudy, with KJ Hamler, Noah Fant, unless he's included, which I've heard that he could potentially be included in a package for Deshaun Watson, but you still have Albert Akwaegbunam. So that's why I think it could be intriguing for Deshaun Watson, from the fact that he has a no trade clause and he can end up having a say in where he ends up. And I think the only way the Broncos move Drew Lock is if it's for Deshaun Watson. That could be the only way that I see it happening, unless it was like for pie in the sky, even bigger than Deshaun Watson, Russell Wilson. But I think that's the only way they would move a guy like Drew Lock, because they don't have someone in place now to take over for him. Now, if they were to get a Teddy Bridgewater, potentially, if the right offer came along, maybe George Payton could do it then. But at least now, I think the only way they move Drew Lock is if it is for Deshaun Watson.
Well, the idea of moving Drew Lock, as inviting as it sounds, is like, well, what is his real value? Like Ian said, I mean, most people thought that he was going to go in the first round, but he ended up dropping and falling to the Broncos, and they took him with their second round pick. So where is his value? And whomever is throwing their name in the hat for Drew Lock, you have to figure, okay, well, it's not going to be for a first rounder. It's going to be for maybe a second or third round. And if you're the Denver Broncos and you're still hoping out or holding out hope for a guy like Deshaun Watson, you're going to need a little more ammunition to pry him away from the Texans. But if you're not looking in that direction, you figure as though I can go out and get a veteran quarterback and I can still draft a quarterback, you know, in the upcoming draft. If you want Drew Lock for a low second round pick or a high third round pick, we're willing to give him to you. We'll do that, right? Because now you've collected more picks where you can go out and make your team better. And this is where I feel, guys, that the Broncos, in my opinion, are looking at this situation wrong, right? Yeah, you want a guy like Deshaun Watson, but are there any other available options out there so you don't have to really mortgage the future of your team? Because if you go out, and I've heard someone mention this before, that I think John Clayton mentioned this, while Drew Lock allows the Broncos to be patient, how patient are you allowing them? Okay, well, you get to week 8, now the Texans say, well, we're tired of this back and forth with Deshaun, now we're going to, you know, trade him for the best deal. At that point, if you're the Denver Broncos and you're still in love with Deshaun Watson, what are you giving up at that particular time? It could be Drew Lock. It could be Noah Fant. It could be Bradley Chubb, Cortland Sutton. So now you're giving up all these pieces to the Texans to pull Deshaun Watson. And then what do you actually have on your team? Just a repeat or rinse a repeat of what he's dealing with the Houston Texans? I don't know. That's why the whole idea, I love it, but how do we get it done? That's the thing that's a huge question mark for me.
A question for both of you. Is Deshaun Watson worth a first-round pick, yes or no? Nick?
Yes.
Ian?
I'll give 3.
Three? Three first-round picks. Oh, man, that's a lot of capital to give up right away. I don't know if I would go 3.
Because as I've said, I've said it on my podcast and I've said it other places, when you get a guy like Deshaun Watson, you're going to be competing in the playoffs and you're going to be in the playoffs. Because I think the Broncos were a competent quarterback away from winning some of the games that they ended up losing. Just look at the Chiefs game where they held the Chiefs to 22 points, yet the offense just couldn't do anything against that defense. So I get that the Chiefs had a couple of drops. Tyreek Hill had a drop in the end zone. But I do think when you get a guy like that, you're going to be competing and playing in the playoffs, especially with this third team now eligible to play in each conference's playoffs. You're going to be picking at the end of the first round anyway. It's not like you're going to be picking in the top 10. So I think that's why it's a little, for me, it's a little easier to give up those picks.
Well, Ian, I'll definitely agree with you, because I would be willing to give up 3 first round picks, right? I would be willing to do that as long as we're not giving up picks and players at the same time. Because if we look at the first round and we say 2022 and 2023, you know, we don't know what those prospects are going to be like. And it's always a gamble when we look at the draft anyway. So if I'm only giving up a first round and I'm able to retain my talent and I'm able to acquire free agents and I still have my picks 2 through 6 or whatever, we're still in good shape. So that's where I would agree with you. But I don't agree with the whole idea of giving up three or four first rounders and players that are currently on your roster. That's where I have my breaking point.
That's where Herschel Walker situations come in.
Right.
With three first round picks, that's where you can lessen, I think, the players that you have to give back in return. You could give up, maybe they take a guy like Drew Lock with three first round picks, because then they have the potential quarterback that obviously he's not on the same level or even the same universe as Deshaun Watson, but they have the picks now that they could get someone who could potentially help them with their picks that they haven't traded to the Dolphins, that they could use to potentially move up and get their next quarterback of the future that they can then trade to the Broncos after about 5 years.
I think either way, we're looking at a situation where if they weren't willing to offer three first round picks from Matthew Stafford, I don't think the Broncos will be anywhere in that neighborhood with Deshaun Watson talks. I could be wrong, but I don't think that's going to head there. Before I let you guys go, I would be remiss if I didn't ask Mrs. St. Clair, what is going on at Play Colorado? Please tell our audience about Play Colorado and where they can find your work.
So Play Colorado, I do my best to keep all the new sports bettors, whether you're on the fence, you're experienced, you've done it before, or just trying to keep everyone in the know about what's going on with sports betting, with gaming, with casinos in the three gaming towns in Blackhawk, Central City, and Cripple Creek, with the lottery, with anything that has to do with gaming. I'm trying to keep people informed and in the know with relevant stories, with news, with fun stories, with things that can give them knowledge to make an entertaining and safe bet when they do it. And I think that's what's so important with sports betting become legalized in the country, is to do it safe, to do it in a fun way where you know that it's something that is, that you trust your gut, that you can do in an entertaining way that adds to the way that you watch the games that you want to wager on and the teams that you want to wager on. And that's what I try to do at Play Colorado.
Now on the flip side, Nick Ferguson is one half of the Nick and Cecil show on 104.3 The Fan. If you haven't checked his show out, from 7 to 10 on 104.3 The Fan every night, Monday through Friday, definitely go over there. Check out what they've got. They have great guests. Nick, who are some of the guests that you guys have had on in the last 2 weeks?
Wow, we've had some outstanding guests. We've had John Lynch, Champ Bailey, Shaq Barrett, Wade Phillips. Just last night, we had Chuck Smith, who participated in Von Miller's yearly pass rush summit, if you want to call it that. And he had some very interesting things to say about Von and about those individuals who are definitely riding him off. And if he also said, if the Broncos decide to part ways with Von, it would be one of the worst decisions they've made, because it's only going to inspire him to be a better player. And then they better hope that he doesn't end up with a team like the Raiders, the Chargers, or the Chiefs, or it's going to be real lights out for the Denver Broncos. So it's going to be really, really interesting. And we got a great guest coming up, Bud Foster, former head coach in DC for the Virginia Tech Hokies. He's going to join us tomorrow to talk about Caleb Farley, a guy who the Broncos could be eyeing with that first round pick, that number 9 pick in this upcoming draft.
Man, you just gave me chills thinking about Von Miller and that red and yellow and white out in Kansas City. That just sent chills up my spine.
That. You don't want to see that.
No, especially no. I think that's the Broncos, every Broncos fan's worst nightmare right there. But Ian Sinclair, thank you. Nick Ferguson, thank you. I appreciate you both for coming on, and I appreciate the listeners for listening to this podcast. And you can catch everything on RalphieReport.com or SBNation.com. But once again, thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.